Hello and welcome to Cobblecast. This is Ro Jacobi. Cobblecast is brought to you by Kabul Now, kabulnow.com, to tell Afghanistan stories to the world, because Afghanistan matters and the stories of its people matter. Now, I want to thank you all for listening to Cobblecast, for commenting on it, for sharing it on your social networks. But I also want to ask you to tell us, tell me what you think. Your thoughts, your ideas, your questions, wherever you're listening from, I like to hear from you as much as I like you to listen to me. As you know, it's almost 2 years since the return of the Taliban. Countless lives have been turned upside down. Whether you're in Afghanistan or outside, please let me know the impact of the past 2 years on your life. We are all about sharing your stories. It's you who matter. In this episode, we hear from someone who played a central role in America's dealings with the Taliban both before and immediately after 9/11 attacks, his thoughts on what went wrong and what should happen next. His stories, well, you have to listen. Robert Gournier is the former director of the CIA's Counterterrorism Center and station chief in Islamabad. He's also the author of 88 Days to Kandahar. I began our conversation by asking him about how he felt as he watched the Taliban capture Kabul and the chaotic and deadly aftermath.
Yes, it was rather devastating, I have to say, because one of the things that greatly preoccupied me at the very beginning, when George Tenet, who was the director of CIA at the time, asked me to put down my thoughts on paper as to how we should conduct the campaign to deal with Al-Qaeda in the aftermath of 9/11. What I most feared at the time was that if the U.S. were to invade Afghanistan and deploy large numbers of troops, establish bases, et cetera, that we would end up in the end like the Soviets. And here we were 20 years on, leaving Afghanistan, certainly not in good order. And all I could think of was that this was the realization of my worst fears back in the beginning.
So you could foresee things might not turn out as a lot of people, the optimists, hoped. And the West's involvement in Afghanistan, Operation Enduring Freedom, really gave the people of Afghanistan the sense that the freedoms that they're going to gain will endure. And it didn't. Who do you put the blame on? It's almost 2 years since since the withdrawal happened and Taliban's return, and they've returned to their default position of what they were in the 1990s. And what are the key factors that you think enabled the Taliban to return?
Well, I think that there's a great deal of blame to go around. And so I mentioned that in the beginning of the U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, or the direct U.S. involvement in Afghanistan, I was very concerned about the possibility of the U.S. adventure turning out like that of the Soviets. But I felt that that would only happen if we were unwise. And there were many different ways to be unwise. But I think a principal mistake that we should avoid would be to deploy large numbers of troops, essentially to occupy the country. And the doctrine that was adopted at the beginning was that we would not do that, that the U.S. footprint would be very light, and that we would work in support of Afghans rather than investing the country, occupying the country, and asking Afghans to help us. And that's the way we started. And there was good success in the beginning, but that's clearly not where we stayed. And as you very well know, at the height of the so-called Obama surge, we had 100,000 U.S. troops, another 50,000 from NATO. We were occupiers of the country, and there were a great many negative consequences of that. But if you take a couple of steps back and try to ask, well, what went wrong? As I say, I think there's a great deal of blame to go around. I think that that the U.S. Basically deformed Afghanistan. We were trying to turn Afghanistan into something that it was not and was not likely to be at any time in the near, even distant future. We created an army that was unsustainable. We certainly didn't do what I would have felt we needed to do in order to empower Afghan leaders. And I think that begins with Hamid Karzai and continued thereafter. But there were a great many other factors as well. And, you know, I think you almost would have to look at the situation almost on a district by district basis. And I think that those who came to power as a result of in various geographies, as a result of the U.S. invasion and the U.S. engagement there, in many cases were not wise, and they favored those whom they favored, and they disadvantaged those whom they did not like, and in many cases turned the population against them and gave an opportunity for the Taliban to reassert itself. And again, so I think it's a story that almost has to be told district by district. Mm-hmm. So it's a very, very complicated story. And, you know, I think that political evolution tends to be very slow in all countries, in all cultures. And I think we were looking for a very rapid political evolution in Afghanistan to go to a representative democracy. And in some ways, I think that a surprising degree of progress was made. It wasn't very pretty. There was a great deal of corruption, et cetera, but this is the evolution in all countries. But that said, I think that a space was made for the Taliban to return. And you could point to any number of different factors.
Does that belief come out of your meetings with the Taliban at the time you were in Islamabad trying to convince them to hand over bin Laden? Or, you know, you've said it before as well that the Taliban could have played a part remaining where they were, providing that they gave bin Laden to the US to be tried. And so does this belief, as I said, come from your meetings with them? What, correct me if I'm mistaken, in your book, 88 Days to Kandahar, that they told you that although you're going to attack us, but we'll be here and we'll come back.
Well, yeah, it was Mullah Osmani. With whom I was meeting at that time. And I guess he was the most senior member of the Shura at that time. And so we had a very wide-ranging conversation. And at various points, he said, you know, if you come here, we will defeat you the way we defeated the Soviets. Again, nobody really knew what the immediate future held in store. At that point, I was trying to see if we could find some way for the Taliban leadership to at least minimally meet the demands that the Americans were making so that we could avoid a war. And it was very clear to me in my own interactions with leaders on the U.S. side, in the beginning at least, that if the Taliban had agreed to change policy and find some way, direct, indirect, some face-saving way to turn over bin Laden to international justice, that the U.S. would have been satisfied to leave the Taliban in place and would not have interfered further. That's clearly not what happened. I think Mullah Omar had every opportunity to do that if that were his choice. I think he even had the opportunity to get religious cover, so to speak, to do that when he assembled the ulama in Kabul and asked them, you know, to guide him. At the time, I thought that he was setting up a scenario where he could point to them and their guidance as the reason why he felt under Islam that he would have to turn bin Laden over. He did not choose to do that. And so at that point, it was really impossible to come up with a reasonable solution. That said, one of the many errors that I believe we, the Americans, and we, the West, made in the immediate aftermath of the Taliban's defeat was that we did not reach out to elements within the Taliban, who, by the way, were freed and empowered by Mullah Omar to deal with the new government, to deal with the new political dispensation. I think if somehow they could have been pulled into the process, maybe history would have been a bit different.
Was it the reason that that opportunity was not taken? Was it hubris?
Oh, I think it was a combination of things. I think, yes, in a way, it was hubris. I think it was anger and resentment. I think it was there was a desire. And you have to remember, the Americans were angry. They were very angry over what had happened. And given the role of the Taliban in providing safe haven to bin Laden and al-Qaeda, there was a great deal of anger, particularly in our Ministry of Defense, our Defense Department. During the war itself, CIA was essentially in charge. But as soon as the Taliban fled from Kandahar, it was the U.S. military that was suddenly in charge. And they had their own way of looking at things. And as far as they were concerned, the Taliban were terrorists and they would not deal with terrorists. Now, that I don't think was an accurate way to describe the situation. There was always a great distinction between the Taliban on the one hand and al-Qaeda on the other. Yes, there were people like Mullah Omar himself who were clearly implicated with al-Qaeda and for whom there would not have been an immediate political role. Again, I think it was almost a willful misunderstanding of the situation in Afghanistan on the part of the Americans that that led them to be unwilling. And I think that they felt that, well, look, these people are the Taliban, they're finished, they're done, they've been defeated. We don't need them. Why would we deal with them now? And so I think we know that now that was not a wise policy to pursue, but that was the policy that was pursued, and I think those were the reasons for it.
And of course, there's this the belief that the Taliban had melted away. There were tens of thousands of soldiers. Of course, they went back to their yes. homes and villages, and yes. the leadership moved into Pakistan. Given the centrality of your position, and of course, throughout the decade, the two decades, why did the US and the West fail to convince Pakistan to give up, in a sense, support the new settlement in Afghanistan and work with the new authorities, find a positive role for itself? And you have a deep, deep understanding of that region, the country, the military, and of course, Afghanistan.
Yeah, you know, the whole story of Pakistan and the so-called double game is a very complicated one. And one of the lessons of the U.S. relationship with Pakistan, which of course extended over decades, and which I'm not sure has still been learned, is that when you set out to try to force a country, even a closely allied country, as we were for much of that time with Pakistan, and you try to force them to do something which they believe is not in their interests, you will fail every time. And why Americans don't understand this is somewhat beyond me, but they don't. And they certainly didn't in the case of Pakistan. And so it was very clear to me, even at the outset, and by the outset, I mean when it appeared as though the war had been won, that the Taliban had been defeated, and as you say, they had melted away. It was very clear that the Pakistani government, the army, the ISI, did not trust this new political dispensation in Kabul. They didn't trust Hamid Karzai. They felt that the government in Kabul was essentially a rump Northern Alliance government. It had long had dealings with India, and they simply didn't trust it. And And that very much showed up in an operational way as well, because as the CIA station chief in Pakistan, the number one on my list of duties and responsibilities at that time was to try to capture as many members of Al-Qaeda who were fleeing out of Afghanistan into Pakistan as we possibly could. And we had the full cooperation of the Pakistanis in doing that. But when information came our way, which suggested the presence of a senior member of, for instance, of the Taliban Shura, who would be potentially available to capture, the Pakistanis never succeeded in doing so. And very quickly, you got the impression that, no, as far as they were concerned, they wanted to maintain an option for the future. And so my attitude at that time, in the very beginning, was that, okay, they see this as being in their interest. They don't trust the new government. They obviously, they could not hope to have good relations at that point with the Taliban. Look at all that they had done to harm the Taliban. Mm-hmm. But they wanted to maintain options for the future. And my feeling was, okay, well, let's not allow this disagreement, even though we never really discussed it, let's not allow this disagreement to get in the way of the things that we actually do agree upon and can actually cooperate on. Mm-hmm. And the burden, it seemed to me, was to us, the West, and the anti-Taliban elements within Afghanistan that had succeeded in ridding themselves of this Taliban regime. It was up to them to make sure that the Taliban never came back. So it wasn't as though the Pakistanis on a whim could decide, well, we want the Taliban to come back and we're going to do that. It wasn't their opportunity to do that unilaterally. So I felt, we shouldn't make the perfect the enemy of the good. Let's do what we possibly can as we go along. And over time, obviously the Pakistanis themselves could not be sure what the future would hold. They didn't have a crystal ball. Mm-hmm. And of course there were efforts that were made over time to establish a better relationship between the government and Kabul and its various iterations and the Pakistanis, and that all came to naught for very complicated reasons that we could spend quite a lot of time discussing. It would not have been possible for us under the circumstances as they were and as they evolved to convince the Pakistanis that they should embrace an anti-Taliban government and actually work against the Taliban itself. But that's where it was.
As you said, there is a lot of blame to go around. And one of the arguments have mm-hmm. been in the West in particular, that from European points of view, they were willing to stay the course. They were willing to support the Afghan government, create a stalemate. It was not costing a lot of money. And you can understand from political, strategic point of view, they've had a lot of worries about the rise of populism, the refugee issue. So they had this practical, as well as mm-hmm. the moral arguments of staying the course. And the argument, as I said, is that had the US stayed, it was not costing a lot of money. It was just that we lost patience. We lost credibility. It became a defeat for us. Afghanistan's become what it's become, home to international terrorism, the Taliban itself, the destructive policies on women, on other ethnic groups, on education, on health, on everything. Afghanistan has become the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. 28 million people Yes. are hungry. What is your assessment of that?
Well, I think that you have just articulated the situation better than I could have, that we were in a situation, as you say, we had less than 10,000 U.S. troops. It was more like 3,000 U.S. troops, I think, that were in Afghanistan. At the end, they were only playing an advisory role. They were, generally speaking, not in harm's way. But their presence, and particularly the financial support, was enabling the government to stay in place. And yes, I think that there would have been a long protracted struggle, but as long as Afghans were willing to engage in that struggle, I felt it was our responsibility, particularly given the relatively minimal cost involved, to support them. So I could not agree with you more. And I think you're absolutely right. It was, frankly, it was the decision of one person. That was President Biden. I mean, well, President Trump, well, you know, we could spend some time talking about his pathologies, you know, this whole America first.
Well, neither so we want to talk about Boris Johnson in Britain.
Not had patience. Perhaps not. and of course he was too disorganized to actually force a policy change through in any in any coherent way. But in the case of Joe Biden, frankly, I just think it was an emotional reaction. And he said, "No, this, we've gone long enough. We have to put an end to this." And quite frankly, I think it was irrational. I think, you know, we could spend some time, you know, talking about the psychology behind it. But in any case, I do believe that it was very unwise. And when Americans now complain about the Taliban and how we must sanction them, and frankly, in ways that harm the Afghan people far more than it does them, you know, my response is, well, what did you expect? You knew what you were handing the country over to. You knew that once we announced our withdrawal, that it was going to fall apart. The only surprise was that it took as little time as it did. Everyone knew that it was going to fall apart. And so essentially, in my view, we collectively handed the country back over to the Taliban. And so, you know, we should accept our responsibility for everything that has happened as a result.
What did you make of the Doha deal?
Oh, the Doha deal, I think, was a thin veil for a withdrawal. We were giving up. We were simply giving up and leaving. And we're looking for a face-saving way to do it. I think it was no more than that.
And I think in Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, or as you call him, Zal in America, has come under a lot of criticism for the way he dealt with the Taliban, the way he managed the negotiations. And, you know, at Kabulcast, we were talking to the former British ambassador to Afghanistan, Sir Nicholas Kay, and he said, to a large extent, Khalilzad was driven by his psychodrama, which, you know, longstanding rivalry with President Ghani. And do you recognize that?
I have heard that. I never saw it close up. And as much as I've had a great deal of interaction with Ambassador Khalilzad in the past, I was not dealing with him in the context of his negotiations with the Taliban. So I really have to defer to the judgment of others. But I think that what the ambassador is saying rings true to me. I think that was an element there. And that's one of the problems, I think, when you have somebody who's leading a diplomatic effort on your side, who is himself very emotionally involved with the issue, with the country, and with many of the key players. And maybe particularly in the case of Zal Khalilzad, who's a very interesting personality. I think that's part of what you're going to get. I think there were members of Khalilzad's delegation who felt that he developed a lot of sympathy with the Taliban, that he, in some way, again, he had a lot of sympathy for them. I think he developed a relationship with them over time, and that he lost a certain amount of objectivity. And I think that he realized going in that he was working for a president who wanted out. I mean, his job, I think, as he understood it, was get us out of there. So he had very few options. I think that he had very limited room to maneuver, and I think that he was dealing with Taliban counterparts who knew it. I think they knew very well that the Americans simply wanted out, and so they had no motivation to make any great sweeping concessions. So I think that Khalilzad had a bad hand, which he played badly.
You advocated for a small footprint in Afghanistan, but there has also been an ongoing thread throughout the 20-year engagement that there was a disconnect in priorities, the political and military disconnection, where politicians and leaders came and gone, wanted something that the military did not understand. So the military objective were completely alien to the political objectives of leaders in Washington. And do you accept that assessment? That, and also in America, to a large extent, Afghanistan became a partisan war. President Obama, before coming to power, he was against the continuation of U.S. engagement in Afghanistan. And of course, President Biden was steadfastly against further, you know, deeper engagement in the country, even as vice president.
Well, I think that the story of Obama in Afghanistan is a little different than what you have described. During the campaign, before he was elected in the 2008 election, he was making a clear distinction between the U.S. engagement in Iraq, which he referred to as a war of choice, which he did not approve of, and what he described as the U.S. war of necessity in Afghanistan. So he felt that we had to respond to the attacks of al-Qaeda, that we needed to prevail in Afghanistan. And when he came into office, he felt that we should reinforce the effort, the U.S. military effort in Afghanistan, and lead it to a successful conclusion. However, within the first 6 months of his administration, when he sent, you know, my old friend General McChrystal to take over command in Afghanistan, and McChrystal did a thorough review of the situation and came back and basically said, this situation is going much worse than you think. And if you want us to succeed, it's going to require a great many more troops, a great deal more time, et cetera, et cetera. So in a sense, I think President Obama was now suddenly confronted with the price tag for the policy that he'd been advocating all along, and the price tag was simply too big. So it caused him to reassess the situation. And I think he made a decision which, in my view at least, was the worst possible decision that he could make. Remember, he was going into this as a Democrat, and you referred to the partisan aspect to all of this. Well, classically speaking, the Republicans are seen as the hawks. The Republicans are the ones who are more militarily aggressive. The Democrats, sort of in the popular thinking, are the ones who tend more to shy away from military engagement. And I believe, I mean, President Obama has never expressed this to me, I believe that he did not want to be in a situation where he could be attacked for not having engaged the U.S. military in a way which gave us an opportunity to succeed in Afghanistan. So what he did, in effect, was to say, okay, fine, we are going to more than redouble our efforts. We're going to have a surge. We're going to send a great many more U.S. troops into Afghanistan, but we're going to begin to withdraw them within 18 months. So he was sending them in to do something which probably they wouldn't have been able to do, even with that number of troops and even over a 10-year period, and said, you're only going to have 18 months in which to do it, which essentially meant it condemned them to failure. The surge never had a chance at success. So it was dictated, I think, largely by domestic political considerations and not by any realistic, wise appraisal or understanding of the situation on the ground in Afghanistan itself. And the U.S. military was eager to gain victory in Afghanistan. And they felt, against all evidence, that, well, once we're engaged there, and if it is clear that we need more time on the ground in order to see the effort through, that surely the president will change his mind and allow us to stay. President Biden, or the Vice President Biden at the time, as I read the various memoirs of people who were engaged there at that time, tried his best to let the military know that what the president has said, the president meant. You have 18 months and then we're going to begin to withdraw. Do not think that the president is going to change his mind and that this is going to be conditions based, in the phrase that was used at the time. And indeed, he was right. Obama meant it. We began, you know, to withdraw very, very quickly afterwards. And so I think it was a thoroughgoing disaster. And one of the problems with the U.S. military, once you get it moving in a particular direction, it has a great deal of resources, has great capabilities, but it has one way of doing things. And that way, the U.S. military way of doing things was simply not suited to Afghanistan. And you know, one of their tasks was to build a new modern Afghan army. They built it along U.S. lines, very much dependent on U.S. logistics, very much dependent on a high level of training, and costing an amount of money that Afghanistan was certainly never going to be able to support under any circumstances. And so, you know, as I looked at all of this from the outside, by that time, I was just shaking my head. I said, this cannot succeed. What are these people thinking? And disappointment.
So what you're saying is, had the U.S. succeeded in supporting the Afghan military for whatever period, and once whenever that support was cut off, the Afghan military would not have been able to carry on because the Afghans did not have the resources to sustain that type of military based on American infrastructure to continue fighting any type of war, let alone fighting guerrillas on motorbikes.
Exactly. Right. And guerrillas and any guerrilla force has the initiative. They can decide where and when to attack. The government's responsibility is to protect everything.
I think it's a quote from a Taliban figure. You've got the watches, we've got the time. So it became a question of that, I suppose. And also, you've dealt with Afghan leaders, tribal leaders in your time in Islamabad. As I understand, before 9/11, the US was interested in some sort of rebellion against the Taliban in the Pashtun Belt. You know, that became more pressing after 9/11. What I'm trying to get at is you've had longstanding relationship, I suppose, interaction with Afghan leaders, and to what extent their inadequacies played a part in the crumbling of the Afghan state. As you said earlier, America at that time, because of being so angry, didn't think strategically long term and used these people, you know, from Gulagha Sherzai to Karzai to General Dostum to all other people. And how do you see that?
Yeah, well, clearly Afghans need to take a larger measure of responsibility for the fate of their own country. Clearly,
yeah.
And you know the factional differences among them. You know the local corrupt behavior that we saw. Just the whole panoply of leadership ills that played out both at the national level and at the local level. Clearly that was all very, very important. And if you look down, particularly at the local level, I think that's what enabled instability to rise and created, you know, local support for the Taliban in many different areas, which, you know, which grew and expanded over time. But I think that the U.S. approach needed to take all of that into account, that we needed to deal with Afghanistan and Afghans and the Afghan way of making war as it was. And who knows, perhaps in the end, no matter what, given the pathologies on the Afghan side, as well as the lack of wisdom on the U.S. And NATO side, perhaps, you know, that it was inevitable that the Taliban would return to power. So that is certainly a possibility. There's part of the American mentality is that if something doesn't succeed, well, then you must have just made a mistake. If you had done it differently, it would have succeeded. Well, sometimes, you know, success is simply not in the cards. Mm-hmm. And this may be one of those cases. But certainly, you know, given the combination of issues on the Afghan side and the huge, what I would regard as the huge mistakes on the American NATO side, there was really very little hope for success. All that said, though, I go back to that earlier point that you made, which was that after, you know, having made what I regard as the huge mistake of the so-called Obama surge, and having gotten down to a point where the U.S. And NATO engagement was sustainable, and where, you know, however rocky and difficult it was, the Kabul regime was able to remain in place and hold its own against the Taliban insurgency. Who knows what might have happened after that? Eventually, perhaps a new Taliban leadership would have realized that, you know, this is going to go on forever and we're never going to succeed. That may have made an impression on them. It may not have. But it would have been to Afghans writ large to make that decision, Afghans on both sides of that political divide. And I felt that it was the responsibility of the U.S. and the West to at least give them that opportunity, given everything that we had done, given everything that we were responsible for during the 20 years that preceded it.
There's another thing is that senior Afghan politicians, they turned anti-American from President Karzai to President Ghani, and also all top leaders in some way or another turned against America while being protected by the same army being funded by American taxpayers. And do you see this as failure of the U.S. or the West in general? I think we are just focusing too much on the U.S. Do you think that it was the failure of the West as a bloc to be able to keep those leaders on side? Or was it because of their way of leading that frustrated America and the West?
I believe it was a combination of the two. And, being American and having been engaged in this issue for as long as I was, my focus tends to be on us and our shortcomings and what we ought to have done differently. And, you know, I think if you just take the case of Hamid Karzai, of course, who was in power for so long, and Americans, I think at almost all levels, were just perplexed by Hamid Karzai. And I knew Hamid Karzai, you know, back in the day, and he's a very emotional sort of figure, I think, and there are both good and bad aspects to that. But Americans really didn't understand why he seemed, in their view, to sort of go mad, why he was so angry with the Americans and what they were doing. And to me, they should not have wondered that he would be as angry as he was. Here he was. He was the nominal president of the country. He had this huge American military force that was operating in his country, operating without very much guidance at all from him, and was producing unintended consequences. You know, for instance, the night raid that were creating, you know, so much death and destruction and turning so many people against both the Americans and the Karzai regime. And it must have been enormously frustrating and enormously humiliating, quite frankly, for Hamid Karzai. I have a great deal of sympathy for him. And I almost wonder why he had as much patience with the Americans as he did. And I think that's the nature of dealing with the United States. It doesn't do things in a small way. It does things in a very big way. It overwhelms almost everything that it touches. And again, I think it was just another aspect of an American posture in Afghanistan that was completely inappropriate to the circumstances. So I can understand why virtually every senior non-Taliban political figure in Afghanistan, one way or another, and to one degree or another, became anti-American. It's because we're just impossible to deal with. And, you know, again, it sort of became, in our view, this is very typical of the United States, it became, in our view, our struggle. It was never our struggle. Our role was to support those whose interests roughly coincided with ours. But it was their struggle. And we very quickly forgot that. That was what sort of the animating philosophy that I tried to advocate in the beginning, and which we followed in the beginning, but which was certainly forgotten and more progressively forgotten, you know, I would say roughly from 2005, 2006 onward. By the time 2009, when the Taliban was making a very serious comeback, and the decision was made to launch a surge, that idea of the U.S. supporting Afghans rather than Afghans supporting the U.S. was completely lost. It was as though the U.S. decided that Afghanistan was too important to be left to Afghans. We took over the struggle, and everything sort of went downhill from there.
Going to what the situation is now, on the security and geopolitical situation, how do you see the region now?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting for quite some time. I mean, if you look at the strategic weight, if you will, of Afghanistan versus Pakistan, clearly Pakistan is the far more important country, and things going wrong in Pakistan are going to have, you know, far more, you know, devastating consequences, both for the region and to some degree for the wider world. And yet it was the U.S. preoccupation with Afghanistan that was driving our policy in the region writ large. Now we're in a very different place, obviously. And I think that the attitude of the Biden administration, which we saw manifested in the decision to essentially to leave Afghanistan, is that essentially they want to leave the entire region in the rearview mirror. There's still a great deal of interest in India, but that's very much in the context of the rivalry with China. And the U.S.
But do you think that is a mistake?
I think that it's a mistake to a certain degree. And we can spend some time talking about what I see as the mistakes that the U.S. are making vis-a-vis Afghanistan. In the case of Pakistan is certainly not going to be as important to the U.S. now as it has been over the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. But I do believe that we should be sustaining a higher level of engagement with Pakistan, and we're seeing right now. I don't say that the problems in Pakistan, which are very, very complicated, I don't say that those are a result of shortcomings in U.S. policy alone by any means. But I think that the issues that we're seeing now in Pakistan could have very, very important implications for the region and for the wider world, and that therefore the U.S. ought to be more engaged than in fact it is. So I do think that the U.S. posture is in the region is probably closer now to what it ought to be, given the narrow U.S. national security interests that are at stake. But I do think that the U.S. should be far more focused right now than it is on the suffering of the Afghan people, you know, quite apart from the Taliban and the unfortunate policies that are being pursued by the Taliban. And I think that the people who are suffering as a result of the disgust, really, of the Americans and the West writ large with the Taliban are the broad Afghan people.
And what would you
take one?
Yeah, if Secretary Blinken called you and said, "Okay, form," in the same way that George Tenet asked you to formulate a policy post 9/11. But if the U.S. government came to you now and said, "Tell us what to do," what would be your prescription?
I would say that we need to be engaged with the Taliban. And I don't want to suggest that it should be anything close to the centerpiece of U.S. foreign policy. It isn't. It's essentially a backwater. We all understand that. But in that limited context, we should be engaged with the Taliban. And we should not try to force the Taliban to do things which we know they're simply not going to do. There are certain things they're simply not going to do. We can try to encourage better behavior, but we ought not, by sanctioning them, and for instance, you know, by having frozen and essentially confiscated the $9 billion in government assets that were seized by the U.S. I think we have thoroughly undermined and vitiated the Afghan economy such as it was. Who has suffered for that? Well, obviously the Taliban suffers for that to some degree, but primarily it's the Afghan people. I think that's simply wrong. And you know, so if you take something like what the Taliban is doing now with narcotics. Well, this is what we've been advocating for many years. The Taliban has done once again. If you had asked me back in 2001 whether anybody could cut off opium production in Afghanistan, I would have said, "No, you're crazy." The Taliban managed to do it at the time, and they're doing it again. Well, I think that this is an opportunity for us to be taking resources, like for instance, you know, these billions of dollars that the U.S. has seized, and investing it in long-term agricultural development in formerly poppy-growing areas. So they're never going to be able to support themselves growing. Go ahead.
Yeah, the counter-argument to that is, by engaging with the Taliban to a larger extent, to a deeper extent, you are playing into their hands and prolonging their rule. Because for many, the Taliban's rule is not sustainable. Given the complexity and the bloodied history of Afghanistan, this is just one phase of Afghanistan's conflict. And is it a picture that you recognize as well?
Oh, yes, I think it is. And you know, one of the things that that we failed, we, the U.S., failed to understand back in 2001 was the degree to which the Taliban had lost support even in the Pashtun-dominated South. And that part of the reason that they gave up in the way that they did was that they understood in a way that we did not how they had lost popular support. They had thoroughly exhausted the country with the war against the Northern Alliance. You know, people were sick and tired of being taxed to the hilt, of having their sons forcibly recruited and sent off to fight in the north. I think they realized that politically they were done. It didn't manifest itself in a great deal of enthusiastic armed opposition. Otherwise, we would have seen more people flocking to Hamid Karzai and to Gulag Sherzai at the time. But clearly, they no longer supported the Taliban. The Taliban understood it. That's why they did. So anyway, it's a very long way of essentially agreeing with you that, yes, that this is the political evolution in Afghanistan is cyclical. So they get tired of the people associated with Karzai and the instability, et cetera, et cetera. The Taliban has the merits that it does. Their justice may be harsh, but it's impartial and it's swift. And they retain a large measure of support, you know, particularly in the clerical class. And so it was almost inevitable, if you will, on this analysis that they would return to power. That said, you know, the Taliban is doing what it does. They're doing now what they did in the past, because that's all they're mentally capable of doing. And they are building up over time a great deal of opposition. And eventually, yes, I think you're right, they would probably be driven out one way or another.
On that point of be driven out, how should the West and the US deal with opposition groups? Especially, I wanted to pick your thinking on armed struggle against the Taliban. Do you think that in order to balance engagement with the Taliban, would you advocate for some sort of for anti-Taliban forces, given, you know, the leaders that you dealt with had to flee Afghanistan in the same manner that thousands of people were rushing to the airport? Mm-hmm. But in exile, still, they have their own constituencies, as people have said. They have their followings, whether they're mm-hmm. Hazara, Tajiks, Uzbeks, and also given the Taliban have completely mm-hmm. sidelined the other ethnic groups. There is also the point, the General mm-hmm. Nick Carter, the former head of the British Army, he was saying before the Taliban's takeover that mm-hmm. 60% of Afghanistan's population are not Pashtuns, and they're against the Taliban.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, yes. You know, I wanted to pick your thoughts on these lines.
Yeah. This reminds me a little bit of a debate that was taking place in Washington back before 9/11.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, at that time, U.S. policy was focused on the need to force the Taliban, you know, to cease its support for bin Laden and Al Qaeda, to cease providing him with sanctuary and safe haven. There were those who advocated increasing our support to the Northern Alliance at the time, as a way of getting the Taliban to change policy. And my view at the time was that would be a mistake. I felt that we should maintain some level of support for the Northern Alliance to the extent that it was possible. We should try to keep them from being completely defeated. But that if we were to provide a great deal more in the way of military resources, they would simply not have the military or ethnic standing to force the Taliban to change its policy vis-a-vis bin Laden, and that if anything, that policy on our part would increase the reliance of the Taliban on the resources that it was getting from bin Laden and from his international fighters, et cetera, et cetera. So I felt that it would have the opposite of the intended effect, and that therefore we ought to be trying to solve what is essentially a Pashtun problem in Pashtunistan. So that was why I was advocating for support to a tribal uprising, because I could see that there was a great deal of restiveness against the Taliban, even in the areas on which they depended for their support. So that was the view that I had at the time. And if we look at it now in the current context, well, there really aren't any viable armed elements that really have a chance to stand up against the Taliban now. Now, perhaps that could change in future. If there were some combination of armed elements in Afghanistan that were capable of prevailing, if given a certain level of support, perhaps at a certain point I would advocate supporting them. But in the meantime, I'm not at all comfortable with the idea that we should be taking actions whose likely effect is simply to create more death and destruction. So I understand that, yes, if we were to take some of the actions that I'm advocating now, that it would have the effect of relieving some of the pressure on the Taliban, and therefore, in some way, at least indirectly, support the Taliban and help to sustain the Taliban. I feel that the alternative is worse than that, because it's just such enormous suffering on the part of the Afghan people, and they need to have the opportunity to rebuild their economy. Simply giving them humanitarian support is sort of like dealing with them, frankly, the way the Israelis deal with people in Gaza. Mm-hmm. You know, okay, fine, we destroy their economy, but we'll keep them alive by giving them humanitarian aid. I don't think that is a humane policy. I'm not at all comfortable with that. And again, I guess to those who are morally outraged by what the Taliban is doing, I would say, what did you think they would do when you decided to withdraw support from the government in Kabul and allow them to return? In a way, and I hope it's more than just "I told you so."
Yeah.
You know, I think that there are no perfect solutions here, clearly. And I don't think that we should relieve the pressure on the Taliban. You know, just to take one small example, you know, in those areas where the World Food Program has found that their food distribution is being seized by the Taliban, being controlled by the Taliban, and in some cases being diverted by the Taliban, and where their response is to cut off that support in those areas, I think that's probably what they should do, and is forcing the Taliban in those areas to say, okay, all right, fine, you go ahead and you distribute, you know, this aid as you see fit. I think that's the sort of engagement, I say engagement with the Taliban, I don't mean just benign engagement. Mm-hmm. I mean, in many cases, you know, tough, adversarial engagement with the Taliban, but still engagement with the Taliban with the idea of trying to make the situation within the limited context that we're talking here better rather than worse.
And of course, the fall of the Afghan state led to hundreds of thousands of people fleeing Afghanistan, and tens of thousands of them well-educated, worldly, which is entirely different to what it was in the 1990s. In terms of engagements with them, if you were to give them advice.
Yeah, and I can understand, because, you know, I meet with Afghans in the United States, and of course the ones with whom, you know, I have contact are appalled by what the Taliban is doing, particularly their policies, you know, toward women and girls. And understandably, what I typically hear is that we ought not to provide any support, direct, indirect, or otherwise, to the Taliban. We need to maintain the pressure on them because they're doing all of these horrible things. And I guess I would be more in sympathy with that view if I felt that there was any hope of getting the Taliban to change policy. And, you know, given the bloody-minded leadership that they have, you know, particularly in the form of Mullah Akhundzada, I don't think that they're going to change. And it doesn't mean that we shouldn't put pressure on them, but I don't think that we should put pressure. The main result of which is going to be broad, desperate suffering on the part of the Afghan people. So I think that the opportunities for the educated diaspora to engage constructively in a way that will help their country and their countrymen are probably limited. But to the extent that they can, I think that they should.
It's been fascinating. I'm really grateful for your time, Robert. To bring our discussion to an end, I always end it with some sort of optimist note, if you can muster some, and also some anecdotes, some amusing anecdote that you dealt with Afghan leaders, and how did you find them? And who are the most interesting people to deal with? And if you could share some stories.
Oh, gosh. I guess the two that come to mind were my dealings with Hamid Karzai back mm-hmm. before the Taliban was defeated in 2001. And I found him to be a very admirable character in many respects, but also sort of a flighty and an unsteady one. Mm-hmm. And just sort of on the top of my head, I'm thinking it was a certain point in that narrative when he was literally, he and a small group of armed followers were literally being chased from mountaintop to mountaintop in Uruzgan province.
Yeah.
And the elders who were with him said, look, we can't defend you. Call the Americans to come in and take you and a small group of us out. And the rest of us will melt back to our villages and we'll regroup, we'll reorganize. And then when we're ready, you can have the Americans take you back in and we'll start again. And that was what happened. But now Karzai at the time was making broadcasts from inside Afghanistan to the global media and saying, I'm leading the uprising. Sorry?
To list the set in particular of the BBC.
Yes, exactly. And say, I'm leading the uprising against the Taliban. So we fly him out to Pakistan. He's there at the airbase in Jacobabad. And the CIA officer who was with him contacts me and said, I think you better talk to Hamid because he wants to go. he wants to go up and meet with President Musharraf, and he wants to meet with foreign ambassadors, et cetera, et cetera. And I said, that's crazy. I mean, he's going to look like, you know, he's a tool of the Americans and the Pakistanis when he's supposed to be leading the uprising against the Taliban.
He's not even in Uruzgan. He's in Pakistan now.
He was in Pakistan, for God's sake. And so I got on the phone with him and I said, Hamid, I didn't even know where to start. And so I said, well, Hamid, you've been telling, the world that, you're leading, the uprising against the Taliban from inside Afghanistan. He said, yes. So I said, and it seems to me that it's very important that you're seen as an independent figure. He said, oh, yes, this is very important. So I said, well, if you go up to Islamabad, you start meeting with ambassadors and giving press conferences, isn't that going to sort of make you look kind of, and the Americans who have plucked you out, isn't it going to kind of make you look like kind of like a tool of the Americans? I mean, it's not a bad thing. And he said, do you think I shouldn't go? So I said, no, I don't think you should go. And so he changed his mind. And so I wasn't sure which was worse, that the fact that frankly, he was being so silly, or that it was so easy for me to talk him out of it. I thought, this is not good. This is somebody who really needs to be a little bit more forceful and have a little bit better idea of what he's doing. So in any case, not to denigrate Hamid Karzai, because I think that, I greatly admire him in many ways, but there were times when, quite frankly, he was just a little bit, he was a little bit unsteady. And the other, relationship that I had that immediately comes to mind was a relationship that I had with the then deputy foreign minister of the Taliban, Mullah Jalil.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very interesting character, somebody who was endlessly manipulative. I think he was trying to find a way in his own way to sort of get the Taliban to change policy and to have this whole war go away. And I think that's why he was talking to me, but there was so much sort of mutual manipulation that was going on, me trying to manipulate him trying to manipulate me, that
such a murky world of that.
It was very, very murky. And one of the things that he, but I knew that he was completely loyal to Mullah Omar. That wasn't going to change. It wasn't like he was going to start working with the Americans against his own people. He was just trying to see, where he could manipulate things that ultimately would redound to their credit. And one of the things that he asked me to do was to make sure that the place where he would stay was it was a foreign ministry guest house. It was off, I guess, close to Kandahar. And he asked me to make sure that it didn't get bombed because that's where he was staying. So I said, okay, all right, fine. We'll make sure that it doesn't get bombed. And I was thinking that once he was convinced that it wasn't going to get bombed, that they would probably start using it for senior meetings. And sure enough, that's what they did. And anyway, so it's a very long story there that they did have, you know, some senior meetings, which I thought, given, okay, well, which is more beneficial to us, to continue the sort of, you know, endless manipulation with Mullah Jalil?
I said Mullah Jalil. Yeah, I just
with Mullah Jalil, or you know, to bomb a meeting of the entire Taliban senior leadership. I thought we should probably bomb the Taliban senior leadership, but the U.S. military was not nearly nimble enough. And when we found out that there was a meeting that was taking place, and we said they should bomb it, it took them hours to actually strike it. By which time I told them, don't bother anymore. But you know, again, U.S. military, once it gets moving in a certain direction, it's very hard to stop them. And so they bombed it. And fortunately, Mullah Jalil was not there when they bombed it. But he called me the next morning to complain. And it is, you know, I mean, it's quite horrible, really, when you think about it. But it's also sort of amusing.
Yeah.
And he said they bombed my place. And of course I tried to pretend as though I had no idea. And I said, oh my God, you know, Haji Mullah, this is terrible. Oh, this wasn't supposed to have happened, you know? And so anyway, he calmed down after a while and we started talking once again about business. And so again, in sympathy, you know, I said, so Haji Mullah, I'm very sorry. So where will you go? And he stopped for a moment, and then he just laughed as if the last thing in the world he was ever going to do was tell me where he was going, because I might have it bombed again. So it was extraordinary.
And you did make it to Kandahar.
Relationship all the way around.
And you did make it to Kandahar after that, didn't you?
Oh, I did. Yeah. So after the Taliban fled and Gulagha Sherzai took over once again as the governor, and of course we had been supporting him, and so yeah, in January of 2002, I went to Kandahar as Sherzai's guest, and had an opportunity to.
And he's quite a character as well, isn't he?
Oh yes, quite a character. He has his good points and his bad points. I felt that we could have done more to encourage his good points. Yeah, it's
one of the characters that I really find fascinating on a personal level is General Dostum. Did you ever have a dealing with him?
Right. No, I never had any direct dealings with him, but some of my colleagues did. Some of my CIA colleagues and some of their special forces comrades, very, very small in number, and they joined with General Dostum's group, and of course, they were. He was moving with cavalry, and so they were riding horses.
Yeah,
and of course, their main job was to help provide him with air support as he was fighting the Taliban. And very early on, after they joined him, he fought an engagement with the Taliban, and so it was sort of a set piece battle, and he sent his forces forward, and they started making some gains, and they managed to punch through the Taliban lines. And of course, by this time, General Dostum was excited, his blood was up, and he said, okay, charge. And they went rushing forward on horses against the Taliban. And of course, you know, my friends, one of them in describing it later, he said, that was exactly what I was afraid of. He said, the last thing in the world in a cavalry charge against the Taliban, but you know, you're there with General Dostum. You don't want to look like a coward. He's rushing ahead. And so they had to rush ahead as well. And so off they go, you know, firing pistols as they went. But again, it was just sort of amusing that their contribution, that the CIA officers' contribution to the fight was going to be minimal at best. They could easily have gotten killed in the process. That's not what they were there for. They were there to provide support. And yet, you know, here they are with General Dostum, you know, who's this sort of larger than life character, and they just get swept off with him. And in some ways, I think that that's almost the story of the U.S. engagement in Afghanistan, writ small.
That cyclical history of Afghanistan of foreign engagement. So this is the last point. Do you think we will get there again? Do you feel the trajectory of Afghanistan and the region, and of course the things going on in Ukraine, do you foresee down the line, as I say, another similar engagements in Afghanistan?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, clearly that the only reason that the West, that the U.S. has gotten engaged in Afghanistan in the past was when there were equities at stake that extended far beyond Afghanistan itself. And so in the case of the so-called anti-Soviet jihad of the 1990s, the 1980s, it was because of the Soviet Union wanting to bleed the Soviet Union, wanting to extract a price. And of course, that was the way things turned out. Similarly, in the U.S. engagement, which began in 2001, it really had very little to do with Afghanistan itself. It had everything to do with the threat of Al-Qaeda. And for that cycle, if you will, to continue, there would have to be some interest that went well beyond Afghanistan itself that would cause the U.S. and other foreign countries to become engaged. You know, Pakistan has its own reasons to become engaged. The Iranians do, et cetera. Maybe others in the region, but certainly for the U.S. and the broader West, the only thing that I could anticipate right now would be that, for instance, the Islamic State in Khorasan to somehow become a greater threat and to be seen as a greater threat, and that its safe haven in Afghanistan would therefore be seen as engaging serious national security interests of outside powers to then somehow induce or motivate the U.S. to become reengaged once again. I don't think we're anywhere close to that right now. But again, absent at least a seemingly compelling national security reason for the U.S. to reengage in Afghanistan, I wouldn't see that happening.
And do you think the influence of China and the huge amount of, you know, already huge amount of investment that Chinese are promising the Taliban, of course, the large, you know, national resources in the country untapped? And do you think because of that, given the China's influence, wouldn't China force America's hands or the West's hands to involve in some sort of competition?
Oh, I think that there would perhaps be some level of competition, but not to the level of the U.S. becoming militarily engaged, certainly. I think that there are important mineral resources in Afghanistan. I don't think they are overwhelmingly important. I think that China will always have, a comparative advantage in terms of its ability to compete for access to those resources, certainly more so than the United States. But right now, I think what we're seeing is that the Chinese engagement in Afghanistan is rather narrow, rather very transactional, certainly, and their overwhelming concern, I think, really has much more to do with Islamic militants who are active in Afghanistan, who could pose a threat to them. I suspect that much of their interest in minerals right now really is related to one degree or another with helping to motivate the Taliban government to do what they would like to do in a counterterrorism context, which is not to say that there aren't important resources that the Chinese would like to pursue for their own value. I'm not sure that it's going to be a huge interest for them. And while it could invite a certain level of competition with the U.S. under other circumstances where the situation on the ground in Afghanistan is more benign, it's certainly not going to get the U.S. to become militarily engaged.
Thank you so much, Robert. It's been insightful, enlightening, fascinating. And I'm so grateful for your time. You've been so generous.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. And thank you for the opportunity to talk about Afghanistan and the region. I have a great deal of empathy the region, and a great deal of affection. May sound like an odd thing to say, given the nature of my engagement, but I have a great deal of affection for Afghanistan and for the region. And that's part of the reason why I feel the way I do on so many of these issues, is that I think that the Afghan people are a wonderful people, and I wish for their sake that they could somehow escape from this cycle of violence and be able to go back to building a decent and a prosperous life for themselves and for their children.
Thank you. I'm really grateful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.